Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, over the years on American Variety, we've done many shows on explorers and adventurers. Three or four of them were on famed aviator Amelia Earhart and the mystery of her disappearance on a round-the-world flight in 1937. And those were aired over a period of years as that search has progressed. So Earhart was known at the time as Lady Lindy, in deference to the even more famous aviator Charles Lindbergh, the first person to fly solo nonstop over the Atlantic Ocean. But nearly a century ago, in 1932, what became known at that time as the crime of the century took place when Lindbergh's only child, 20-month-old Charles Lindbergh Jr., was kidnapped from his home and was later found dead. After a long and frenzied search, 2 years later, a German immigrant carpenter named Bruno Hauptmann was charged with the crime, convicted, and electrocuted. But now, nearly a century later, the case is back in the news because of a bizarre new theory that brings into question Hauptmann's guilt and focuses attention on a much more surprising suspect. My guest to talk about it today is Lawrence Lusberg, a prominent criminal defense lawyer in New Jersey who has just gotten involved in this effort to see if justice was actually served back then or not. Welcome, Mr. Lusberg.
Thanks, Court, and you can definitely call me Larry.
Okay, good deal. Thanks for being on. So first, if you would, just give us a brief summary of the kidnapping itself, you know, the actual crime, the event, and the discovery of the boy's body 10 weeks, I think it was, later. What happened?
So this is not my strength to talk about the history of this matter. I'm, as we'll discuss later, I'm much more interested in whether the conviction was unjust and whether it should be appropriately the subject of the kind of exoneration work that I and others do. But with regard to just the background, on March 1st, 1932, it was discovered that Charles Lindbergh Jr. was missing from the nursery where he slept. Charles Lindbergh looked around the house with a gun and was immediately concerned that something had happened. And after, as you said, a frenzied search, a couple of months later, the child's body was found by a truck driver who was passing by in a nearby area.
Yes, I mean, at the time, they did find outside the house that night a ladder leaning up against the house, a two-story house. The boy was asleep in the second story of the building, right? And
right.
There were people home at the time, and it was kind of weird that they were, you know, having dinner. They had company over. There was a dog in the house, and it was raining outside, and all of this went on unbeknownst to anybody, right?
Yeah, it's one of the sources of the current concern that perhaps not only that Bruno Hauptmann was not an appropriate defendant, not only that he was innocent, but also that Charles Lindbergh himself may have had something to do with it. I'm not really here to talk about that theory, although it's a theory that's been accepted by some and disparaged by others. What I do think, and you focused on the latter, is that there's real doubt as to whether Bruno Hauptmann committed this murder. And when I say that, I am not at all writing on a blank slate. This was, as you correctly called it, thought of as the crime of the century. And in the almost century since that time, many people have questioned the accuracy of the verdict, which resulted ultimately in Bruno Hauptmann's execution by the state of New Jersey. People like me get involved in cases where there seems to have been a terrible injustice in which a suspect really should have been, I used the word exonerated earlier, based upon new types of evidence that has become available since that time. And that's what I've been focusing on.
Yeah, so that was kind of a spoiler alert that kind of the focus of the new part of the investigation that's highly controversial is that Colonel Lindbergh was involved in it, which, you know, off the top would be like, what? But we'll get into some of the reasoning and the rationale behind that. But and I know that you said you're not, you know, you're not an historian, you're not deep into the details of the investigation or whatever. But, you know, maybe let's talk a little bit about that to the extent that both of us know something about it. So one odd thing that I read was that Colonel Lindbergh insisted that the police not attempt to find the perpetrator because he feared the investigation would endanger his son's life. He only allowed the investigation to proceed when the child was found dead. So when it did begin, I mean, were there any immediate suspects at all? And, you know, how long did it go on? I mean, what's kind of the background or the context of the whole thing of finding the child finally and then beyond that?
Yeah. As I understand it, the investigation, not surprisingly, at least initially, focused on a ransom note that was discovered at the scene of the crime. That ransom note was analyzed and followed up on, but the case got a tremendous amount of publicity even back then in the 1930s. It received attention as far up as President Roosevelt. And there was a sort of gigantic dispute as to who would handle it between the New Jersey State Police. And ultimately, in May, after the body was discovered, the FBI took over the investigation. But all that aside, numerous people surfaced to say they knew something about it. And initially, from what I understand of the history, a lot of the focus was on organized crime and whether this had been an organized crime hit of some kind. There were members of organized crime who took credit for it or who said that they knew who the gang was who had perpetrated the offense. There were others who actually obtained ransom payments and then, of course, knew nothing and nothing came of that. And in fact, one of them at least ended up being prosecuted for embezzlement. It was one of those infamous crimes where people come out of the woodwork to try to make profits on it themselves. But in the meantime, you know, crime detection was not in the 1930s, you won't be surprised to know, what it is today. The crime scene was not carefully preserved. And in fact, people flocked to the Lindbergh residence, all kinds of people, I think many well-meaning, to offer help or to see what they could see. And in the process, you know, stamped down in the mud beneath the window so that footprints could not be discovered. There was cleaning of the room, as a result of which fingerprints were lost. A lot of types of evidence that these days would be carefully preserved were lost in the process. And as you pointed out, Charles Lindbergh himself did not take steps that would be consistent with somebody who was really trying to solve the crime. Now, we all think today of Charles Lindbergh very differently than he was thought of in 1932. Since that time, it's come to all of our attention, you know, that Charles Lindbergh was a notorious Nazi sympathizer. So the hero that he was then is not the way he's regarded today. And I think that's partly responsible for the way that many view him in thinking about this offense all these years later.
Yeah, it could be. But by the same token, he was revered then. And so they gave him such deference and such leeway in what he wanted to do and not do that a normal person wouldn't have been given, you know, so it kind of went to the opposite extreme then. But so with all that going on, how long did the investigation go on before they finally did stumble on Bruno Hauptmann, and how did they do that? Because that's a little interesting too.
So I really don't recall how long it went on. It was a couple of years. Yeah. Eventually, the way he was tracked down was that certain of the ransom payments, which were in special gold notes, were traced to him. I believe it was about 2 years later. His explanation of that was that someone had given him those notes, and so he had nothing whatsoever to do with his involvement in it. He always, until the day of his death, denied any culpability and asserted his innocence. That was always the case. This is not a case where there was ever any kind of confession, coerced or otherwise. And it's worth noting, I mean, he was, when arrested, beaten and never did offer any sort of confession, always asserted his innocence. But as I understand it, and again, this is not particularly my area of expertise, he was originally located by virtue of having the ransom payments that were made, and there were ransom payments made, traced to him.
Yeah, and as I read, you know, it's kind of like what you said, but to elaborate a little on it, he said that a German friend of his who had visited from Germany had brought this package of money to him and asked him to hold it for him until he got back. And then the man left and went to Germany. Of course, that's a little dubious sounding already. But anyway, that was the story. And I think his wife had an alibi. And of course, a wife could have an alibi made up for a husband. So, you know, all of that was kind of squishy, but still he had the money. You know, so they followed the money.
Yeah, they did. But it's important to note the name of that German person who he said gave him the money to hold was Isidore Fisch. It's spelled F-I-S-C-H. And Isidore, there was evidence that was discovered after the conviction, and indeed after, I believe, after punishment was imposed, that is, his execution, whereby four police interviewees identified a picture of Isidore Fish as potentially at the scene of the crime. So there's some corroboration for his perspective. There was evidence going the other way as well. There certainly was evidence offered at trial that Hauptmann's handwriting resembled the handwriting on the ransom notes. There was some evidence at trial that he had a drawing of the type of ladder that was ultimately used, and I think we should come back to the ladder a little bit later. But this was a case with the way we think about it these days. It's not even really as so much a circumstantial case as a case with very flimsy evidence. Unusual to have a murder with no confession, with no forensic evidence really connecting him to the crime. And it's those things, among some others, that caused me to be interested in this about a century later.
And of course, at that time, with Lindbergh being who he was and the police having a lot of egg in their face, not having really found a clear perpetrator, they were in a hurry to find that person. And when they thought they'd found the one, they were in a hurry to convict him and get him done.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear. I mean, the lessons of this case are easily transported to the present. There are convictions every day in this country that are unjust, and many of them take place because the crime is horrific and there's tremendous pressure on law enforcement to come up with an answer for it. So even though that was the crime of the century because of the celebrity of Lindbergh and even his wife, the pattern of having law enforcement rely on flimsy evidence to solve a crime and getting it wrong is something that we've learned takes place all the time. And it's one of the reasons why those of us who do this kind of exoneration work do it.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. We're talking with attorney Lawrence Lustberg about the long ago infamous case of the Lindbergh child kidnapping. And it's kind of back in the news lately because of a theory that a former judge in California has put forth. So let's talk about that. Her name is Lise Pearlman, and she has a theory that's, some people are kind of buying into and others think is outlandish. So could you kind of give us just the general outlines of that theory, Larry?
Yeah, I mean, I can give them to you in sort of summary form. There's Charles Lindbergh was a believer in eugenics, which is the process whereby sort of the ideal human beings are created. It does have the ring of Nazism to it, and it was certainly part of the interest that Hitler had as well. And there's some evidence that Charles Jr. was not perfect. He had an overly large head, which is symptomatic of potential infirmities. And so there's been this focus on, did Lindbergh, working with others, actually take actions that really resulted in his death, potentially killed him, put not too fine a point on it. There's other evidence as well, and this is an important one. When the body of the child was discovered, it was preserved in a way that many believe would have required the types of chemicals to which Hauptmann would never have access, but which Lindbergh might have had access to. I think this theory is what I would call it, is embryonic. And I think those who are promoting it, including Professor Pearlman, are not saying that there's conclusive evidence right now, but is arguing very hard that we should look harder at the evidence that is there to once again ascertain whether they got the wrong guy. And there's reasons to be concerned that they've got the wrong guy, as I mentioned before, as is the case in many criminal convictions in the United States.
And also at the time, Lindbergh had been working with somebody named Dr. Alexis Carrel, who is a Nobel Prize-winning surgeon and an organ transplant pioneer. And so another odd thing about this was that apparently when the child his body was found, I think the only organs still in his body were a heart and a liver. Everything else was missing. And the police at the time decided that that was because it had been mutilated by foraging animals, but the autopsy didn't otherwise indicate that kind of damage that you'd be torn apart, you know. And so that was kind of a strange thing too. And again, the guy's an organ transplant pioneer, and Lindbergh's sister-in-law had a damaged heart valve. So all of this begins to, you know, Lindbergh might have been interested in trying to find some cure for her or a replacement part for her, you know. So all of that plays into this kind of conspiracy theory that's popped up here. And I think was given some credibility by the scientific community in a sense, because she, Professor Perlman, presented her theory not long ago at a conference held by the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, which is an outfit that doesn't let anybody walk in the door and start talking. They, you know, they have peer review panels and they vet people before they allow them to speak. So they gave her some credibility by doing that. And that gave some visibility to this theory as well, right? So,
no doubt. But, you know, one thing to remember about this kind of theory is it gets no traction unless the underlying evidence that was produced is suspect. That is, the reason you start looking around for other possible suspects is when the one that got convicted is where there's doubt, when there's real doubt as to whether he did it and as to whether the prosecution theory, you know, holds water. And so the fact that there are reasonable attacks based upon new technology and even new law, and I can explain that, is what gives rise to even thinking about the idea of other suspects. There were other suspects even at the time, including the housekeeper and, you know, at the Lindbergh residence. But really what we focus on today is the question about whether there was not only sufficient evidence to convict Hauptmann, but whether that evidence had evidentiary integrity. And this is the kind of thing, as I said, that those of us who do this kind of exoneration work focus on day in and day out.
Yeah, so we're getting into your lane now, Larry. So, you know, as an attorney, how well do you think the evidence in the case was used or maybe misused? I mean, what was the evidence? It was pretty sparse, but I mean, they had a ladder. They had some pieces of wood in his attic that resembled the wood that was used in the ladder and, you know, things like that. So, I mean,
sure.
Kind of line up how you would view it as an attorney from your perspective today.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that, Court. So the reason I've been interested in this case is that there's really two strands of law these days that cause you to take another look at convictions. One is new forensic techniques, and the other is, at the time, 1932, there was not a constitutional requirement that the state produce what we call exculpatory evidence. There's a famous Supreme Court case called Brady. You sometimes hear it referred to as Brady evidence. And that's evidence that shows that the defendant was actually innocent. In this case, there's both of those two things. So let me start with the forensics, and particularly let me start with the latter that you talked about. It was a major part of the prosecution theory that the ladder that was outside that they found leading up to the nursery on the second floor was made of the same wood as a missing plank of wood from Hauptmann's attic that they found when they searched that attic after his arrest a few years later. That theory seems completely misplaced for a couple reasons. First of all, the planks don't even match up. And in some of the research we've seen, that's very clear. But more to the point, we now have techniques where the wood could be carefully analyzed from the attic and the carefully analyzed from the ladder, and you could really see whether it's the same wood. I mean, that would not be impossible to do today or as difficult to do today as it would have been then. And so what a lot of people are thinking about now is, can we get that kind of testing done? And while DNA from, you know, saliva and whatever, you know, can deteriorate over time, wood testing of DNA can absolutely be done a century later. The wood is there. It can be analyzed. The techniques are available. And we can really have answers to the questions. And the real question for me is, why wouldn't we try to get those answers? I mean, you could say that, Hauptmann is long ago dead. This is a century ago. We should have other priorities, and fair enough. But this is the kind of thing that can be done, and given the public attention to it, it seems like a good idea. Particularly because there are other forensic problems with the state's case in this case. Let me give you a few examples. There was the cause of death on the case was alternatively, there were two different theories that the prosecution put forth. One was that a chisel that had been found in the nursery had been used to essentially bash in the infant's head and kill him. The problem with that theory is that no blood was found at either the scene or when the body was recovered. The alternative theory of death was that he had been dropped by the kidnapper while coming down the ladder and had immediately died. And that was a theory that that was also put forth sort of contradictorily, but whatever, by the prosecutor. But it's pretty clear that dropping even from a second floor a child into what was a muddy outside would not have been enough trauma to immediately cause death, such that there would be no blood and no bleeding at the scene of where they recovered the body. There's other forensic issues as well, Court, and one is that there was this issue about whether there was mud on a suitcase that was beneath the window of where the kidnapper would have had to come through to get the baby. And there's some photographs that indicate some years later mud on that suitcase. Obviously that would have been consistent with someone coming into the room and tracking mud onto that surface. But at the time, witnesses said nothing about blood, and there were pictures taken of that suitcase that have no mud. That's the kind of forensic evidence also that could be analyzed in an effort to decide whether there was, you know, reasonable doubt, whether there's actual evidence of exoneration. So those are the sorts of forensic evidence that would be available here. Let me also say, and I mentioned before, that the other prong of things that we look for is exculpatory, that is evidence of innocence, that was not turned over at the time. And there was a lot of that in this case. Just for example, fingerprints were taken from the ladder itself. The disclosure was that there were none, after which whatever was on there was erased. But there was one fingerprint that did not identify to Hauptmann, that was not revealed to the defense. That today, that would have to be revealed to the defense. And you can make a pretty good argument that, if any good lawyer can make a pretty good argument, that that's strong evidence that somebody else committed the crime. But that's not all. There were other types of exculpatory evidence, one of which I mentioned earlier, from the time. There was a lab report that implicated an older person who had white wrist hairs that would not have described Hauptmann. There were the police interviews I mentioned earlier of people who identified Isidore Fisch. There was a neighbor who identified a slim man who also had a sectional ladder in his car, was at the foot of Lindbergh's driveway at dusk on the night of March 1st, 1932. This was all information that was known to the prosecution at the time and never revealed to the defense. Seems outrageous, and really is from a pure fairness perspective. But I should note, in some fairness to all of this, that the law, it wasn't until 1966 that would have been required. And there were other issues. This go-between that I mentioned is a guy named John Curtis, who acted as a go-between for Lindbergh, who gave the New Jersey State Police in 1932 detailed descriptions of six self-described members of the kidnap gang, who he said he had met with to try to arrange the child's safe return. Again, inconsistent with the idea of Hauptmann being involved. And again, this is the sort of thing that fortunately, couldn't happen today. But those of us who look at convictions after the fact and try to exonerate those who should never have been convicted. Look at just those sorts of categories of things: powerful forensic evidence and evidence that prosecutors failed to turn over that is consistent with innocence.
Okay, well, we're down to where we just have a minute or so left, Larry, but I think it's fair to say that you think there was not enough evidence to convict him of first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt at that time or at any time. Fair?
So it's a really interesting question, and I would put it differently. I don't know about evidence at that time. But what I would say is, as we look at the evidence today, it feels like that is a seriously unjust conviction. It's hard to transport yourself back in time and know what evidence existed where at the time. But, you know, today, with the benefit of almost a century of hindsight, better technology and better law, I think that there's very little doubt that this conviction could not be sustained under the legal standards of today. And that's what I would say. Was Charles Lindbergh responsible? You know, there certainly is some evidence of that. Really, no doubt about the fact that, for example, you know, he had the body of the baby cremated immediately, which, you know, today would be sort of a sign that, you know, the further forensic evidence couldn't be gathered. I mean, I think that history will decide what his culpability was or was not. But I think today we can say that the evidence was weak.
Yeah. So, I mean, it went from an open and shut thing from the public standpoint back in 1934 or whenever that was, to being more murky and more inconclusive, not nearly as open and shut, right? So,
here's the truth, Court. We have open and shut cases. There are cases that are open and shut. This one is the furthest thing from that, at least with the benefit of hindsight, better law, and better forensic techniques.
Well, I think we are going to have to leave it there. So let me just say that the Lindbergh kidnapping has inspired dozens of books and movies and documentaries and even mm-hmm. musicals. I mean, it's been, you know, bigger than the OJ trial by a factor of 10, you know. So, and Lise Perlman's book, The Lindbergh Kidnapping, Suspect Number One, The Man Who Got Away, that's the one we were talking about with the new theory that we were discussing earlier, that Lindbergh should be suspect number one. And, you know, probably the most prominent of the other books on the case is The Case That Never Dies, The Lindbergh Kidnapping by Rutgers University Professor Lloyd Gardner. And that was first published in 2004, long before this latest theory emerged. But it still looks at many odd aspects of the case, even beyond those we've talked about here. There's another one being written by investigations editor for the Associated Press named Del Quentin Wilbur. So it is indeed the case that never dies. And I guess we'll leave it there. It's not something we're going to solve right here and now, Larry. But thank you so much, Lawrence Lustberg, for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you, Court. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, and thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.